What?
College matters.
What?
College matters. Matters.
Really?
For sure. College matters.
Alma matters. Matters.
And this Oct 4 factor was one of the factors which actually could have bound to that 8 nucleotide sequence, ATGC-AAAT, in globin that I had been working so hard to identify 40 years ago. So the lesson was in magnanimity that this tiny inconsequential thing that I did actually ended up 40 years later being actually a huge, or at least it was a small piece of a very big puzzle.
That is Dr. Anil Menon, professor of molecular genetics and associate dean of the undergraduate program in medical sciences at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine. Hello, I'm your host, Venkat Raman. As a kid, science for Dr. Anil Menon was a dinner time conversation with his parents, who were both scientists. Dr. Menon enjoyed those discussions. As a young boy, he was fascinated with Mendeleev's periodic table of elements. This fascination led to his lifelong commitment for science in general and molecular biology in particular. He was involved in significant research in emerging areas from recombinant DNA, the Human Genome Project, to cardiovascular genetics. Along the way, he learned that the arc of fundamental research bends eventually, research by research, sometimes well into the future. In this podcast, Dr. Menon reflects on his journey into the then emerging field of molecular biology, working in Cold Spring Harbor Lab at SUNY Stony Brook, PhD in Jerry Lingerl's lab at the University of Cincinnati, postdoctoral work with the Human Genome Project at Harvard, and his professional career at the University of Cincinnati. Now, before we jump into the podcast, here are the high fives, five highlights from the podcast.
And I fell in love with the periodic table of elements. Mendeleev's periodic table of elements. And I loved the fact, just thinking about it sometimes at nights before I fell asleep, I would think about how all the atoms in my body were made in the stars. And, you know, all those little hydrogen and helium nuclei had fused to form, you know, sulfur and iron and all those kinds of things. And then eventually, like, here is this creature, here is this sentient creature who can think about the universe. And everything came out of that simple periodic table. It was only 4 years after a huge advancement had been made in molecular biology by Paul Berg and Stanley Cohen at I think it was UCSF and Stanford, where they had actually cloned a piece of DNA. So that was, you know, the birth of molecular biology. Jerry had a number of different projects going on in the lab. And we worked on the mRNA, which is the RNA that encodes the proteins. And this was early work on these mRNAs, and these mRNAs were very unstable, so they would break down very quickly. And an added dimension of that is I got to work on a part of the Human Genome Project, that is specifically on chromosome 14, and it was being assembled by a number of different groups. So many times when you think of the Human Genome Project, you think of like this one entity. But it really consisted of a lot of different laboratories working together in bits and pieces. And one of the bits and pieces was being put together by John Edwards in England at Oxford University. And so I interviewed at several places, but the place that resonated with me most was Cincinnati, partly because I had long connections here. I had been a student here, so I knew people. It would not be starting everything from scratch. And also, it was a very exciting project to study cardiovascular genetics. It was to take it to the next level. So what do you do once you have a gene? So human geneticists can find these genes. And then what do you do with that gene?
These were the High Fives, brought to you by
College Matters.
Alma Matters.
Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. For my newsletter, visit almamatters.substack.com. Now, I'm sure you want to hear the entire podcast with Dr. Menon. So without further ado, here's the podcast with Dr. Anil Menon.
Why don't we start with your background? Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got to where you are today.
Venkat, first, thank you very much for inviting me to this podcast.
Absolutely.
It's a privilege. I am very interested in stories of origin because I do believe and have observed that our stories don't begin with us, nor do they end with us. So I'd like to tell you a little bit about my parents. My parents grew up in India, but they were very unusual. They came to this country in the 1950s, and they both were scientists. I became very interested in science for, I think, two or three different reasons. One is I think the conversations around our dining table were all very scientific, and we always enjoyed those. And I fell in love with the periodic table of elements, Mendeleev's periodic table of elements. And I loved the fact, just thinking about it sometimes at nights before I fell asleep, I would think about how all the atoms in my body were made in the stars. And, you know, all those little hydrogen and helium nuclei had fused to form, you know, sulfur and iron and all those kinds of things. And then eventually, like, here is this creature, here is this sentient creature who can think about the universe. And everything came out of that simple periodic table that Mendeleev, without doing any real experiments, and this was an example of truly brilliant intuition in science. And so it allowed me to just fall in love with a subject in which there were so many ways for us to make an inroad. One is, of course, you can do it by experimentation. Like if you look at Millikan's oil drop experiment, it's a marvel of experimentation. You know, the beauty of the experiment is so great. Then you look at Mendeleev and Darwin. They didn't do a single experiment in their life, and yet they changed the world with just the power of thinking. And I just I was just in love with science, and I went into it very starry-eyed. And I still have a bit of that starry-eyedness, you know, now that I've been in the business for more than four decades. I have seen, of course, the dark underbelly that exists. But on the other hand, the starry-eyed part has never gone away. So I think I will always be a scientist. I think I'm a little more... you know, I view it with less naivete now than I did when I first started, but it has not changed. I think the atoms that comprise me have been touched with just the joy of doing science, and I will always be a scientist.
So you started your undergrad in science. I mean, how did you chart your course from there?
I was a chemistry major, and I loved chemistry. It was no surprise, of course, that you love Mendeleev.
Periodic table, exactly.
Yes. And then slowly over time, one of the things is I was at the State University of New York at Buffalo. Mm-hmm. And the State University of New York system mm-hmm. has an amazing laboratory called the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, which is on Long Island. Mm-hmm. And it's principally run, at least the academic function is principally run by the State University of New York at Stony Brook. Uh-huh. But young people could come there and spend a summer or mm-hmm. Spend some weeks at least of the summer at that laboratory. And the head of the laboratory was no other than James Dewey Watson of mm-hmm. Watson and Crick.
Yeah.
So it was quite a wonderful thing to get an experience to see all these amazing things. And this was in probably 1980. Mm-hmm. And it was only 4 years after a huge advancement had been made in molecular biology by Paul Berg mm-hmm. and Stanley Cohen at, I think it was UCSF and Stanford, where mm-hmm. they had actually cloned a piece of DNA. Mm-hmm. So that was, the birth of molecular biology was, I think you can argue it in a lot of different ways, but that was really the first time recombinant DNA was shown to be empirically possible. Mm-hmm. And I had, as a 20-year-old, started working in a lab in 1980. And, mm-hmm. and so it was only 4 years after that. So it was a time of great excitement. There was mm-hmm. a person there whose name was Jerry Lingrell, who subsequently came to the University of Cincinnati. And mm-hmm. I decided I would do my PhD in his laboratory. I mm-hmm. wanted to do my PhD in his laboratory because while he was at Caltech, mm-hmm. he had discovered a molecule which was an intermediary between DNA and protein. Mm. And today we know that as RNA. So mm-hmm. he was, among others, it was not discovered by one person. He was one of the people who showed that RNA was of two different sizes. So if you looked in the nucleus of any cell, mm-hmm. you would usually see a long piece of RNA. Mm-hmm. And then when it was in the cytoplasm of the cell, it would be a short piece of RNA. And mm-hmm. I will fast forward to the modern time without going into all the complications there. But that piece of RNA, which comes out of the nuclear RNA, is actually mRNA. Mm-hmm. So it was Jerry Lingrell in Cincinnati and Philip Leader at Harvard who co-discovered it and had back-to-back papers in one of the most prestigious journals in the field called Nature. Mm-hmm. And it was a very exciting time. I felt like, just out of instinct, I felt like there was something here to be done. I wanted to work in a new field. I always felt an attraction to innovation. Mm-hmm. I could have gone into a more traditional field like organic chemistry or physical chemistry or something like that. But molecular biology was kind of the stuff that I had dreamed of as a child, all these atoms being put together into a sentient being. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important for a young person listening to your podcast from high school to think about what they dream about at night, if it is sort of scientific and so forth, to pursue those dreams and to make them a reality. So I came to Jerry Lingrell's lab knowing, but at the same time, not knowing what I wanted to do. Because like anything, mm-hmm. everything looks exciting when you are 20 years old. and you don't know a whole lot about a subject, it looks very exciting. And when you enter the subject, you realize that there are 1,000 different paths that go in 1,000 different directions. And you will suddenly be faced with a great deal of perplexity, and you don't know which path should I take. And so the qualities that I was looking for in a PhD advisor, given the fact that I didn't know much, was somebody whom I felt had a degree of trustworthiness and simplicity in which they would work with me. In other words, they would not make it too complex for me. And Jerry Lingrell was just such a person. And I just give him a shout out. By the way, I actually wrote his obituary along with one of his other students just 2 years ago. I think it was 2021. And so you can find that if you just Google Menon and Shull.
Sure.
So you know a little bit about him. So I entered his lab just knowing that he published a lot of papers, which was important to me because I knew that it was important to publish papers if you wanted to be in academia. And I also knew he was doing this exciting work in recombinant DNA, which was brand new at the time. And it was so scary for so many people that there were people who actually came to the lab from from various municipal offices asking, this is the municipality of Cincinnati, asking whether this was a danger. That would there be recombinant animals or other such creatures that were being created? You know, so there was wild speculation and not much knowledge. So Jerry actually spent a lot of time educating people about what exactly it was and what were the types of controls that would be placed. And it was his work along with many others that actually ended up creating this draft copy and subsequently guideline for the use of recombinant DNA and moratorium against its use in humans way back in probably the late 70s and early 80s. So it was an enormous contribution to the ethical dimension of science. And so it was a wonderful time to be in a lab which was at the forefront of that. In the course of my PhD, I spent a lot of time learning that science is one of those things where you have to be prepared to work long hours, and you have to be prepared to be wrong a lot. And that actually was the hardest struggle for me. I had generally been used to taking just like regular doing reasonably well and things like that. So it was a real, you know, it broke me to do an experiment and just not get the answer that I had thought I was going to get. And that was the hardest part of it. So I would have a hypothesis that I'm going to, you know, this is exactly how it works. And it didn't. And so then I would regroup and it wouldn't again. And I'd regroup and wouldn't again. And it was one of the most difficult things. But what it did is it built in me this persistence and to some extent, some degree of ability to change one's hypothesis, because the universe is the universe. You can't change the universe. You can change your hypothesis. So it taught me a very important lesson in life that could also be applied to human beings, is that you can't change everything.
Yeah.
But if you change the way you frame it, then it changes. And I think somebody else said it, but I don't know who said it. It may have been like Sartre, you know, or someone like that. But basically, if you change the way you look at something, it changes for you. I mean, it has a kind of, you know, quantum element to it, sort of like Schrodinger's cat kind of thing.
Yeah.
The observer changes what is being observed simply by observing it. And the observed thing changes the observer simply because he or she is looking at it. Okay. So it was a powerful lesson that lasted me for my life. We were working on globin genes. Now, these are the genes that encode the protein that is the protein component of hemoglobin. So blood, for example, is made in mammals of hemoglobin, which is an iron center. That means the metal at the center is iron. And then there are several chains of proteins that are attached to this iron through coordination type compounds. Coordination type bonds. And essentially what we would be working on is the protein part of it. And it's easy to work on that relatively because you can access it. All you have to do is get some blood. So, you know, you could get blood from different animals and so forth. And Jerry had a number of different projects going on in the lab. And we worked on the mRNA, which is the RNA that encodes the proteins. And this was early work on these mRNAs. These mRNAs were very unstable, so they would break down very quickly. And 40 years later, of course, they had mastered the art of making stable mRNA. And then the rest is history because they've been used as the mRNA vaccine.
Right.
But we did work on what proteins actually cause mRNA to be made. Because mRNA is the intermediate between DNA and protein. So there is something called a central dogma where DNA is converted to RNA, and then RNA is converted into protein. So we were working on that step of converting DNA into RNA, and that is called transcription. During the course of it, and this, the great lesson that I learned in there is the lesson of serendipity, and also the lesson of magnanimity in science. My PhD thesis ended up being on a group of proteins that bound to a unique 8-nucleotide sequence. So the 8-nucleotide sequence, I still remember it like it was yesterday. It was ATGC triple AT. So that was the 8-nucleotide sequence, which was found in front of all the globin genes. So we used to call it the octanucleotide binding site. And the technology was such that we knew the site in the DNA at which the proteins bound, but we didn't have the technology to isolate the proteins that bound to this site. And 40 years later, or actually it was almost 35 years later, a whole family of these octanucleotide binding proteins was isolated by various people in all parts of the world. And these are called the oct sequences or oct proteins. So there's an oct 1, oct 2, oct 3, oct 4. And oct 4 is one of the most important proteins that is involved in stem cell formation. And it is one of the four principal factors called the Yamanaka factors, which were identified by Yamanaka in Japan,
mm-hmm.
which can convert any cell in your body into a stem cell.
Mm. Wow.
And this OCT4 factor was one of the factors which actually could have bound to that 8-nucleotide sequence, ATGC-AAAT, in globin that I had been working so hard to identify 40 years ago. So the lesson was in magnanimity that this tiny inconsequential thing that I did actually ended up 40 years later being actually a huge, or at least it was a small piece of a very big puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt a sense of kinship. So I read all of Yamanaka's papers with great interest. I have to tell you a little bit about the Yamanaka factors because your audience will not know. So I have to give you some context to this.
Sure.
When is your birthday, Venkat?
June 4th.
This June 4th, will you be getting older or younger?
This June 4th, I'll be getting older.
Okay. So why is it that we get older and we don't get younger? So why does the direction of aging go in only one direction and not the other? And so the genesis of this question occurred to a German scientist whose name was August Weismann.
Mm.
In the mid-1850s, mm-hmm. and he, to make a long story short, basically said there are two types of cells in the body. Most of our body is made of these somatic cells, mm-hmm. which age and which inevitably grow old, and that is why the body dies. However, there are a few cells in the body which end up being our germline cells, and these are the cells which go on to form sperm and eggs and so on. Mm-hmm. And that germline can live forever, theoretically. You know, it just goes from generation to generation, generation to generation. Mm-hmm. Whereas the somatic cells all die. And so the theory, it was called the Weismann barrier, is that germline cells can make somatic cells because, you know, like if you have children, part of your germline is actually part of their somatic cells.
Mm-hmm.
But somatic cells cannot make germline cells.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was this unsurmountable Weismann barrier, which was a dogma for many, many years, until somebody did an amazing experiment. And that is, this is a person called John Gurdon did this experiment where he transplanted the nucleus of a somatic cell into the cytoplasm of a germline cell.
Yeah.
And to his great astonishment, the somatic cell nucleus was reprogrammed and you could get a germline cell out of it and you could make a whole animal out of it. So these experiments were done in a frog called Xenopus levis. And so it was possible to take a skin cell nucleus from a frog and put it into the cytoplasm. And there were factors in the cytoplasm that could reprogram the somatic cell so that it became a germline cell.
Wow.
And so what was in the nucleus? It was nothing less than mRNA. But it was more than that. It was mRNA for some very specific factors that were involved in switching on and switching off genes. And these are called transcription factors.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those very important transcription factors is OCT4. And that OCT4 is that same OCT4 which could bind to the ATC, AAAT sequence, which I was searching for but never found.
Mm.
So I had I had hints of it. I knew precisely that it was binding to this 8-nucleotide sequence, but I just never knew what that protein was. I couldn't purify it or anything. Didn't have the technology, didn't have the knowledge, the skill, everything. In 2006, Yamanaka won the Nobel Prize for the discovery of four factors that could actually take any somatic cell and convert it into a stem cell.
Wow. Wow.
And that offers great hope for people with, where can we use this technology? We can make stem cells that may help people with spinal cord injuries, for example, to put a patch of stem cells that will regrow into neurons and help fix that. What about artificial knees? Today, artificial knees are made of metal and plastic, but in the future, these stem cells might be able to regenerate the cartilage that is missing in many people who have osteoarthritis and things like that. Similarly, if someone has a myocardial infarction, in other words, a heart attack, there are a lot of myocytes, that is cardiomyocytes, which are killed or which die in the process of a heart attack. And so it's possible in the future that some stem cells might be available as a patch to regenerate cardiomyocytes. So it offers immense potential. And there are many companies actually currently, Regeneron and others, which are 100% focused on all those applications. But the research in Jerry Lingrell's lab on mRNA and on the OCT binding factor all went in such a beautiful way, which I could never have imagined in my life. And it taught me that no matter how humble my initial observations were, that a student should never feel like their work is too humble, because just let the arc of history roll on and you might be astonished at where the work you do takes you. So this is giving encouragement to all students who are working in all different areas, whether it's engineering or science or whatever it is. You may feel that my work is insignificant, but we don't know this because we don't know how history will unfold. And even the most dreary and humble of experiments that you're doing, the most humble of work you're doing in the lab, maybe other people are working on what you think are exciting projects and you may think you're working on a sort of a dull project, they have the possibility, like Cinderella, from turning in from rags into suddenly this great princess. So these things can all happen. And so the lesson I learned from Jerry's lab 40 years later was that no matter how humble your project, stay interested in it and do your best and let the universe unfold.
What were the barriers, you think, just to when you were doing your thesis? You said technology was one thing. There was no way for you to purify and find Yamanaka, I guess, was able to see 40 years later or whatever, 35, 40 years later.
Yeah.
Is it just better tools, better technologies that were able to help in seeing better and looking at it closer?
It was partly that, because now, you know, there are like supremely sensitive devices called mass spectrometers, where you can take picogram quantities of material and you can determine their atomic, atomic composition and molecular composition, things like that. So that's one. But the other thing is, I personally didn't have the vision, and I have to be sort of, you know, as a scientist and as a human being, at some point we have to be quite honest about why things don't work. And some of it is technology and some of it is other things, but sometimes we simply don't have the vision, and nobody could have had that vision. I was in my mid-20s at that time, and I didn't know enough, and I hadn't read the literature. The internet had not been invented.
Yeah.
And so I never knew of the work that was done by John Gurdon on the Xenopus laevis. And I never knew of a lot of other things. And so I would say that the major reason was that I didn't even imagine what that octobinding sequence could do and what it would be and what that octobinding factor would be. So that was the barrier. I didn't have the vision. So sometimes when something doesn't work, I think it's helpful to have mentors because they may have some vision that you don't. And when I say a mentor, I don't necessarily mean some old and wise person. I think if you have people that are energetically thinking about the question at hand, regardless of how old or young they are, and regardless of who they are, there's a great egalitarianism in the universe that you can get brilliant ideas from anybody if one listens hard enough and if one understands and looks for the big questions. And so it was a very powerful lesson. It was also sort of something humbling, but at the same time, something quite joyful. I felt so happy.
Of course.
I was a different stage of life, of course, when Yamanaka got his Nobel Prize. But I was just so happy that it was something that I was familiar with.
That's amazing. That's really great to be part of something like that. So you did your PhD and then you went to Harvard. Now, what brought you to Harvard? What was the problem at hand or the opportunity in your mind that brought you there?
So just around then, Jim Watson, of whom I've spoken before, he, regardless of the things he says, so he's not a popular person and he says some truly horrible things, and in no way do I support everything he says. However, he was a visionary and he had come up with this idea. What if we sequence the whole genome, the human genome?
Yeah.
The human genome is 3 billion base pairs. So that is 3 × 10⁻⁹ base pairs. And most people would use a very, very slow form of sequencing, which had just been invented by Maxim and Gilbert, and then subsequently by Fred Sanger in England. And so those teams had just invented sequencing. So you could sequence, you know, let's say one nucleotide per second. That would be the speed at which you would do. And can you imagine how long it would take to sequence 3 billion base pairs? Do you know how long that would be? It would be about 100 years. It's 95 years or so.
Wow.
So it would take... So when Watson originally proposed this, he was laughed at. And there were also people who said, oh no, the Genome Project will just waste money and it'll take money away from really good science and all those kinds of things. But in the end, Watson turned out to be right. And I should also say that perhaps there were other people other than Watson, but Watson was the voice of the Human Genome Project in the early years. And it was an exciting time. And a lot of that work, like Maxim and Gilbert, they were both at Harvard. There were other people at Harvard who were using genome technologies, which were in their infancy, to find disease genes. And one of the people doing that was a scientist by the name of James Gazzella. And so he was known as Jim Gazzella. And he was famous because he was the very first person to identify the location of the Huntington disease gene. So this is the gene that causes the disease called Huntington disease. It's a neurodegenerative disease. But this process is such a laborious process that sometimes you can know the location of the gene, but you may not find the actual gene. So it's kind of like you may know that a tiger lives in a particular part of the forest, but it may be impossible for you to find the actual tiger. So you know where the tiger is, but you don't know where it is specifically. And Jim Gazzella had been remarkably successful in cloning a number of different genes, that is identifying a number of different genes. And I think he may hold the record for the most genes identified by any one person. So I decided to work in his lab, and it was a very intense experience. I learned a lot. Jim Gazzella is one of the smartest people that I had run into. He was very, very smart. I got to work with a lot of different types of people. And the lesson I learned from there, as I mentioned to you in our previous discussion, was that it's important as a human being to be able to work with everybody.
Right.
That there are all different types of people in this world. And it's possible to do great science, and it's possible to do great things if you're able to work with a vast number of personalities. And so when you think about the discovery of insulin, Banting and Best and all the other people that were involved in that particular purification of insulin, they had very different personalities. It was not all people with the same personality, and yet they were able to work together, sometimes on better days and sometimes on worse days, but they worked together to reach a bigger goal. And that's what I learned in Jim Gazzella's lab. So it was a very productive time in my life, and I learned a lot. An added dimension of that is I got to work on a part of the Human Genome Project, that is specifically on chromosome 14. And it was being assembled by a number of different groups. So many times when you think of the Human Genome Project, you think of like this one entity, but it really consisted of a lot of different laboratories working together in bits and pieces. And one of the bits and pieces was being put together by John Edwards in England at Oxford University. And John Edwards, for reasons which I have no idea why, but he liked the work I was doing. I was doing some work on chromosome 14 and mapping it and so forth. So as a very young person, you know, I was barely 27 or 28 years old, he invited me to come to the Genome Consortium in Oxford and help put together some of the maps of the chromosomes. And this John Edwards is also, he was subsequently knighted. So he's now
Sir John.
He was Sir John, yes. And sadly, he passed away about a decade ago, but he was a very brilliant guy. And he was one of the people who more or less invented amniocentesis and chorionic villus sampling. You know, when babies are born, sometimes there is amniocentesis that's done, or chorionic villus sampling that's done if the ultrasound indicates that the child may have Down syndrome or any other chromosomal abnormality, or if the age of the mother is high, it's routinely done today. But that whole process was invented by John Edwards. And in fact, there is a very famous syndrome called the Edwards syndrome, and that is trisomy of chromosome 18. You may have heard of Down syndrome, where there are three copies of chromosome 21, and Edwards syndrome is the next most common syndrome, and that is three copies of chromosome 18, in every single cell of the human body. Normally, every single cell of the human body has just two copies, one from your father and one from your mother.
Mm-hmm.
And in a trisomy, you either get two copies from your mother and one from your father, or two copies from your father and one from your mother. So one of the great bonuses of working in Jim Gazzella's lab was the opportunity to meet someone like John Edwards and have him as a mentor for me for many years.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just it was a chance occurrence.
So after Harvard, you came back to Cincinnati.
Yes.
You came back because Jerry called you back and he had some projects in mind, or a yes. lab in mind that he was creating, right? So tell us a little bit about that. I mean, so you come back to Cincinnati, and obviously that's home turf now. So.
Yes, yes. It reminds me a lot of the Robert Frost poem, The Road Less Traveled.
Yes.
And the part that I remember most is, I shall be telling this with a sigh, somewhere ages and ages hence, two roads diverged in the undergrowth, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference.
Yeah.
So that was a powerful thing that I look at today. After I, when I was at Harvard, a postdoc is a very uncomfortable position. You don't get paid much and you have to work a lot.
Yeah.
And by that time, I was married. I had two little kids who were born in Boston, and I felt like I couldn't support them on a postdoctoral salary. So I was looking for a real job, and that would be in academia, because I loved science, and I thought that that would be a good fit. And so I interviewed at several places, but the place that resonated with me most was Cincinnati, partly because I had long connections here. I had been a student here, so I knew people. It would not be starting everything from scratch. And also, it was a very exciting project to study cardiovascular genetics. It was to take it to the next level. So what do you do once you have a gene? So human geneticists can find these genes. And then what do you do with that gene? So yeah. What we were trying to create was to create a center at the University of Cincinnati where we could take genes and we could put them into embryos and create whole animals in which the gene was either overexpressed or knocked out. And this work was pioneered by Jerry's recruitment of a very extraordinary person whose name was Tom Deutschman. And Tom Deutschman was one of the people who developed the technology of embryonic stem cells. That is, you could make a full mouse out of this single cell. And he had been recruited to Cincinnati. So for me, that was the biggest draw, that I could take my science to the next level. It's one thing to find a gene. It's another thing to actually understand what the gene does in mammalian development. And so we would do these experiments. The center was built to do embryonic stem cells in mice, which is a common organism that is used because it's relatively cheap compared to any other animals. You know, when you think about, you know, you wouldn't want to do this in dogs or cats or something just because the costs are so prohibitive. And so so I had the good fortune of working with Tom Deutschman for decades. And he truly turned out to be an absolutely fantastic scientist. He is another person whom I always think of as having been an absolutely transformative person in my life. And he was an example of a person who was just absolutely brilliant, but also a wonderful human being. And a few decades later. So I got to work with him for at least 2 decades. And then he went on to the University of Arizona at Tucson, from which he retired. And he's still living in Tucson, still very bright and active, mm-hmm. and a good friend indeed. So mm-hmm. the lesson I learned coming back to Cincinnati was, number one, look for an environment where you can have your own imprimatur. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is, if you go to a university where there are 5 or 6 Nobel laureates already there, mm-hmm. it's unlikely that you will have much oxygen, because they're taking all the oxygen in the room and sucking it up.
Yes.
And so for a young faculty member, it's much better strategically to go to a smaller place where you get to breathe and you get to create some impact, and where students will come and work for you rather than saying, I'm only going to work for a Nobel laureate, and since you don't have a Nobel Prize, I'm not going to work for you. So because of that, it was a wonderful experience. I was very interested in the handling of sodium and water, because mm-hmm. they comprise almost 60% of the human body weight. And mm-hmm. this sodium and water has to be moved around in your body very efficiently. Mm-hmm. And it is the cause of many cardiovascular diseases. So if you've heard of heart failure, which mm-hmm. is one of the most common things, you get edematous. So that means your lungs fill with water mm-hmm. and your legs fill with water and all those kinds of things. And so how does that happen? And are there genes that are involved in all those things, and can we study them? So I was very interested and involved in that. Mm-hmm. And it was one of the best things that I did in my life over the 20 or so years that I worked on that project. And there were many genes. There were probably almost 20 or 30 genes that we worked on. Mm-hmm. And it revealed a lot about the roots of cardiovascular disease.
Anil, I have one more question and then I'll let you go. I know you've given me a lot of time. And this is something that it just intrigues me. I mean, so, you finished your undergrad and you came over to Jerry's lab to do your PhD. Now, what was it that attracted you to that whole new emerging area? I mean, what was that passion? And it is obviously something that you've been able to run with, and it has made your professional life, so to speak. So what do you think that was? I mean, was that, how did that passion or interest, it started with periodic tables. How did it end up there?
I lived it literally, in the late 70s and early 80s. That is when molecular biology actually was invented, if in fact if one looks at a timeline of invention. One might say a great milestone was the structure of DNA elucidated by Jim Watson and Francis mm-hmm. Crick and Rosalind Franklin in 1953, I do believe. That was a big milestone. But then after that, the next big milestone was to take a piece of DNA from one bacterium mm-hmm. and to recombine it with DNA in another bacterium. Mm-hmm. And this was done by Paul Berg and Stanley Cohen mm-hmm. At Stanford and UCSF in, mm-hmm. I believe it was 1976 or 1977. And it was just around the time I was finishing up all my undergraduate work and so on, and coming to sort of the conclusion that I had to do something in life. I couldn't just stay in school forever. Right. And so this was the most exciting stuff, that it was possible to take a piece of DNA from one organism and actually grow it in another organism. So mm-hmm. I was so excited by that idea that it's possible to take this. And you know, this is what I was learning in my just regular classes.
Yeah.
You know, this is didactic education in those days. That is, you sit in a class and you read a paper and, you know, and then you get tested on it and stuff. So, so it was very exciting to me. I had read Jim Watson's book called The DNA Helix. Mm-hmm. And I used to be a voracious reader of biographies and autobiographies of scientists. I read the biography of Marie Curie. Mm-hmm. I read the biography of Mendeleev, of so many other scientists, of Rutherford. One of my favorite experiments of all time is a physics experiment called Millikan's oil drop experiment, where he calculated the value of E, the charge on the electron. And it's such a brilliant and simple experiment. I mean, any one of us could have done it, but we didn't, because we didn't think of it, you know. And it harkens back to, you know, why didn't I find the factor that bound to the octa nucleotide? It wasn't technology, it's just I didn't think of it. And my mind could not wrap around the hugeness of the significance of what had been discovered. And Millikan was in his simple but beautiful experiment. And if you've ever done it, you can, you know, now it's done in high school. It's like high school kids do this stuff. And if you just look through the microscope at a little micrometer and you see this oil drop like floating, and it actually stops in midair. It's so magical. It is just utterly magical. And that the, you know, the electronic, the electrical attraction between the electron and the positively charged plate above it equals its mass. And it's like just too cool. So so I do think that that the excitement of science allowed me to see the excitement of recombinant DNA and what Berg and Cohen had done. And by the way, that was when they formed the company called Genentech. And so it was they that formed that company. And, and you know, the rest is history. So the whole biotech industry in California and other places is a result of that early finding that you could take a piece of DNA from one bacterium and clone it into another. So so that's what got me so excited.
Sunil, you do have a fascinating story. Thank you so much for sharing it. And it's just wonderful to talk to you. And thank you for the opportunity. And we'll talk to you soon. Love to have more conversations, but I know I've taken up a lot of time, and I hope you had dinner, by the way.
I did. Thank you, Venkat. It is truly a pleasure to share these things with you, knowing that there are students out there, and I was one of them, you know, 40, 50 years ago. And if our discussion, the questions you ask, the insights or discussions that they trigger, if it helps them, if it helps even one of them, then all of this would have been so worth it. So I truly think it's a privilege for me. Thank you for inviting me to be on your podcast. I truly hope that some of the high school students and maybe college students who listen to your podcast might find even one little grain of helpful stuff.
I'm sure they will. Okay, Anil, good night.
All right.
Take care. And
good night. Bye.
I'll talk to you soon. Yeah, bye-bye.
Hi again. Hope you enjoyed our podcast with Dr. Anil Menon of the University of Cincinnati School of Medicine on his journey through molecular genetics. I hope this podcast inspires you to pursue your passions and embark on your own adventures. Bear in mind Dr. Menon's learnings along the way. especially the role of serendipity, the need for magnanimity, and a commitment in the face of elusive outcomes. I wish you all the best in your future endeavors. For your questions or comments on this podcast, please email podcast@almamatters.io. Thank you all so much for listening to our podcast today. Transcripts for this podcast and previous podcasts are on almamatters.io/podcasts. To stay connected with us, subscribe to Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify, or visit anchor.fm/almamatters to check us out. Till we meet again, take care and be safe. Thank you.
College Matters.
Alma Matters.